Let's resume. As I said, what I want to do is take about an hour to show how the cup-based parser, the LALR parser, works. And then our final half hour, we'll just open it up to questions on old midterms or topics of interest or whatever. In fact, what I think I will do on at least one of them, since there's still an ongoing interest, in fact, maybe I should do it now just to make sure I find time to do it. On one of the exams, there's a sort of an interesting variation on what I just got done talking about. Namely, they delete the first character. And remember, for some, oops, let's check that over. That we did an example where you deleted the first character or the last character. And there's an exam question which kind of generalizes that, that I think represents a good way to test your comfort level with engineering or building finite automaton. And that's one, I forget the exact name of it, but it says, take any regular expression that does not generate lambda, just as before, but now I get to generate, delete one character anywhere I want. And again, that sort of makes sense. It's a situation there where you have something where you're transmitting information and it's a bit unreliable. So occasionally a character gets garbled and you don't know which one it's going to be. So the example I showed you previously was guaranteed to be the first character. I talked to some people as an example about losing the last character. And the notion for that one was you find all the states that are one character away from a final state. And what you do is you create a lambda to a new final state and make the old final state or states non-final. The notion being you match everything in R up to the last character and then jump via lambda to a final state, therefore losing the last character. But both of those are nice, but you can build something that is even more general. So now it's a situation there if I had A, B, C, D, and E, I could lose the A, but only the A, or I could lose a B with the other four being in place, or the C, or the D, or the E. Now again, this is at least as hard as the other cases we had, because at least in those situations, you knew you were either at the very start or the very end. Now it's sort of in the middle. You're going along, and all of a sudden, time for the bad character. And you've got to anticipate that, and then continue on scanning. And of course, we're only doing one character, because if you anticipate losing two or three or four, you lose so much information, you have nothing at all to go on. But I could certainly imagine that if I was doing some sort of app where somebody was typing in a command or maybe writing by hand on a stylus something, and handwriting being the way it is, I'm kind of amazed that many of these tools that allow you to do handwriting in are as good as they are. In many cases, unless you have really bad handwriting, they can recognize what you're saying. So it's a situation where maybe one character gets smudged or, you know, you get a little twitch or something when you're writing and it just doesn't come out right. So here's the situation we have. Let's visualize it. We have a regular expression, a finite automaton for Mr. R. And it's got a start state there and some final states. And I'm just drawing this, you know, it doesn't have to be two final states and it don't have to be over in the corner. And can anybody come up with an idea? How can I go about modifying this so that it loses one character, but only one character? And remember, be careful, because if something's in the middle of a plus, so I had something like this plus, I could lose one B, but not two Bs. So I couldn't say lose the B on the first iteration and lose another B on the second iteration, because now I had lost two characters, and my rule is I can only lose one. So that seems kind of tricky. So let me give you a little bit of a hint. And this is really, I'm going to make a second copy. And if I can make one copy, I can make another copy. And does anybody give anybody enough of a hint of what my idea is going to be? So we already know how to lose a character. That is, do a transition that would have been under a character and make it a transition under lambda. But in the previous cases, I had a guarantee it was only one. In the one case, I guaranteed it because it was the start state into from the start state into another state, and you can never go back to the original start state. So that lambda transition could be touched only once. In the other case where we lost a character at the far end, you were one character away from a final state. You took a lambda to a new final state, and it was final. No more transitions anywhere. So it says work your way up till you're all ready to go for the very last character, and then do your jump, and you're done. But now, how do I generalize that, doing something here where I do a lambda to lose a character, but I only do it once? Anybody got any idea how I might go about doing it? Well, let's look at this guy and say, we'll look at each set of states that have a transition under them. And we'll just go through them and call this S1 and S2. And we'll simply look at each of those things and it says, well, here's a spot where I was in S1 and R, and I read character C and I went to S2. And I'm going to do a whole series of these. You know how it all works. I read another character, do another transition, etc. But among all, if I take a path through R, among all the character transitions, I can only have one disappear via lambda. So how do I go about doing that? Remember, I have a duplicate down here. So what might I do? Say, here's S1 sitting here. Exactly. Isn't that a beauty? So what you do is, this guy gets one shot, and only one shot, of taking a transition that would have been from S1 under S2 to character C and goes down below via lambda. But I can only go down. I can never go back up. So I guess it's like going to wherever our precious K's is. We're going down, down, down. Last semester, we were on the second floor. Now we're on the first floor. Now we're down, we're in the dungeon somewhere, right? Where if they catch you smoking in the bathroom or something, they send you to the dungeon for an unlimited period of time. Or even that, I guess. Now it's not just smoking, I guess. You may have noticed over in Mirror, they pulled out the soda machines and the soda vending machine. So I suspect some of you people were buying that Mountain Dew. You know, what's the extra strong double Mountain Dew, the kind that's got double the dose or whatever? You know, knocking back a couple of those and the food police decided that was bad. So you can't even do that. Well, anyway, so notion here is what you do is you go through R. Oh, one more thing you need to do is these final states become non-final. They still exist, but they're not final anymore. Why do we need that? Because, and the start state is only up top. So you got to start at the top, you got to end at the bottom. And what does that guarantee? That guarantees you take one lambda somewhere, but only one. And there's your loss of characters. So now look at how cool this is. You just start again, and it could be the start state even. Every place where you could have read a character, now's your chance. If you want, you can delete that character by going to the corresponding successor in the bottom machine. You can only do that once, but you've got to do it exactly once. Because if you don't do it at all, you never get to the bottom machine where the final states are. So this is a construction. And again, it's a proof by construction. Somebody was asking me a moment ago, how do I know this works? Well, what happens is this has to delete a character because they have to go down below. It can only delete one character. And the character it deletes corresponds to any one transition in the original machine. Could be at the very beginning, at the very end where I'm going to a final state, somewhere in the middle. Even if it's in the middle of a loop, it doesn't matter. If I had something like this, I can loop around some number of times and finally decide to take the lambda. But once I take the lambda, I go to a loop down below, which doesn't have lambdas. So if the thing's cycling around exactly once and anywhere in the middle of the cycle, it drops down and then it continues on as per original machine. So there's another example of how you kind of do that grammar engineering. You situation, take an automaton and modify it as slightly as possible to get the desired effect. Normally, adding characters to a machine is easy. That's just adding new transitions. It's this little trick of deleting characters very judiciously that's a little less obvious. So that is in one of the old exams. I don't remember which one, but if you see it, now at least you know the basic idea behind that. You're saying to yourself, my gosh, how could I have ever figured that one out? Well, maybe you didn't. But one of the cool things about this exam versus what we did in 367 is you get choices. In fact, typically, I can guarantee you'll have at least one question you can skip. If it turns out to be you hate these kind of automata questions, skip that one. There'll be other ones that ask about JLEX or regular expressions. There are even some of them that actually ask about programming. And again, if you looked at the early exams, there were some things. What did we have in there? We have one question, I think, about conditional inclusion, conditional compile, where you have a marker that says, if the marker is true, compile, which in our case is scanning these characters, otherwise skip them. And those sort of things appear in real compilers. And you can actually program through JLEX to do those sort of things. So if you looked at the old exams, you may have seen that. If you haven't as yet, when you get around to preparing, you'll see it perhaps then. So I'm skipping over this because we actually covered this last time. I just included it to make sure that it was in the archive. 6.1 through 6.5.1 is what I'm talking about today. And that's how JavaCup works. Well, we're going to get inspiration from a very odd sort of situation, and that was the Badger basketball game on, what was it, last Sunday. It was certainly an exciting game. And one of the things that I've heard rumors, and again, it doesn't happen here because you're all such saintly people, but people actually make a prediction as to which team is going to win and back it with a little coin. Now, I know you'd never, ever do that here. That's terrible. And there's all the situations in there. And it turned out that one of the hard things about doing this is if you're doing this in a place that's legal, like Vegas, you got to make the prediction before the game begins. But what if you could somehow wait a while? Maybe you had a bookie who, well, not a bookie, but a financial advisor who accepted your predictions, that they'd let you wait until the game was in progress. So, for example, in the Badger game, they opened, I think it was a 4.5-point underdog. And I was kind of surprised because, you know, for facing a number two team, that's not a bad deficit. I guess what, at halftime, they were 3 points down. I guess that's a little bit better, 4.5 down to minus three. And as anybody who watched the game noticed, at the point where there's 2 seconds left, they were tied. And there, the prediction was probably in the Badgers' favor because they had enough time to make a play. And if they messed it up, the worst that happened is they went to overtime tied. And, of course, anybody who watched the game knows what happened. So my insight was that if I'm allowed to see more and more and more and more of the game, I can make a better and better and better prediction. It doesn't always work because there was another game where, who was it, Northern Iowa was ahead 10-plus points with under a minute, and they managed to blow it. Boy, I tell you, I'm glad I'm not president of Northern Iowa. So I'm a firm believer is coaches cannot win games for you, but they sure can lose games for you. And whoever that coach was, I mean, I don't know, maybe he's a great guy, but anybody who lets his team, you know, drop 10 points the way he did, I won't say any more. Maybe he's your cousin or uncle or something like that. So anyway, here's the insight, what we're going to do with parsing. All this paper. Oh, here's a clean page. So the hard part we had when we were doing LL parsing is just like in Vegas. We had to do the prediction before we ever started doing any matching. But suppose that the parser was nice enough to allow me to make my bet later. Now, what do I mean by make my bet? Well, in this case, I'm making a prediction. Remember, we're not betting because that's bad stuff. That's evil and sinful. But predictions are okay. So you're trying to make a prediction that this particular production is the one that ought to be chosen. So you start out with maybe A goes to B, C, D. LL says, just like in Vegas, I have to say before I ever start matching that right-hand side that this is the production I want. But suppose the guy was a little nicer and says, hey, wait a minute, I'll let you wait a little while. I'll let you wait until you determine whether or not there actually was a B there. So I can do some scanning and parsing and say, was there a B or not? If there was a B, well, cool. That means there's a higher likelihood this is the right production. And if there wasn't a B, for sure, this is a loser. And I say, no, I'm not going to go ahead and do it. If I can find somebody who's even more generous, he'll let me wait until I see if there's a B and a C. And then I have to say, yes, this is the right production, or no, it's not. And if I can find one who's really gullible, he'll wait until the game is all but over. You know, the fraction of a second when the ball was in the air and it hadn't quite swished yet, but it was pretty obvious it was going to. And you say, okay, I put a huge sum of money on the Badgers because I think they're going to win with 1/100th of a second left or whatever. And that's the equivalent of having seen B, C, D. If I've seen the entire production, I've got a really good feeling this is probably the right one, because I've seen some B stuff, some C stuff, and some D stuff. Well, that sounds a little too good to be true, but that's exactly what the kind of parser that Java Cup does allows you to do. It allows you not to necessarily predict at the beginning of production, but wait, possibly all the way to the end. And finally, when you've seen the entire right-hand side, you say, I'm pretty gutsy. I think that's the right production. Let's go with it. And because you have more information, you're likely to do better. Certainly, it's a situation there where at the beginning of the Badger game, with them being 4.5-point underdogs, I assume the smart money was going against them. But by the time they got to the end of the game, the smart money is with them because it was more obvious they were likely to win. So let's see how that all works out in parsing. So what we're going to develop is something called the LALR parser technique. Again, this is just one of those terrible names like physicians have for various bones or various muscles or something. It doesn't mean anything. It does actually mean something. LA doesn't mean Los Angeles, in case you're from there. It means look ahead, which is kind of silly because all parsers look ahead. That means they take a peek at the input before they make their decision. And LR means I'm doing a left-to-right parse, and I'm creating a rightmost derivation rather than a leftmost derivation. It's one of these technical names that doesn't give you a lot, but it is the technique that's used in Java Cup and historically in things like Yak, which is the C version, and Bison, which is the Free Software Foundation version of Yak. And why do they call it Bison? Well, Yak is whatever animal family Yak is in. Bisons are also in the same thing. What are they, ruminoids or something like that? What are they? Ruminants, that's good. So that's why they chose that name. See, not all computer scientists are ignorant. They just pretend to be. So it's a bottom-up approach, and here's what I was talking about a moment ago. We're going to have this notation when we build a parser, just as I showed you, where the dot says, here's as much of the information as I have already. So saying, I'm considering that maybe X goes to A, B, C, D was the production that should be selected. But I've been allowed to have some extra information. Namely, I've been allowed to match input that did in fact match an A and match input that did in fact match a B, and C and D have yet to be taken care of. So the further this dot goes to the right, the more information I have that this probably is the correct production. So that's the notion of delaying as long as you can, and the longer you delay, the more information you have, the better a choice you can make. In contrast, you can imagine that an LL-type parser, predictive parser, always has to make a decision when the dot is at the far left in front of the A, saying, maybe A, B, C, D is the right production. I'm going to have to decide it now. If you can do so, fine and dandy. But if you allow me to match A and B and then make a decision, I'm likely to be able to make a better decision. And we'll see, in fact, that's true in some examples. So the dot is just a marker saying how much I've seen. A production with a dot is called a configuration. It just says, think of it as a bookkeeping trick where this is how much you've gone through and this is how much is left to be done. And if I'm able to move my dot all the way to the far right, that's pretty close to a guarantee. Not quite, because we also have to use a little bit of context checking. But it says this, I've matched an A, I've matched a B, I've matched a C, I've matched a D. It really, really, really looks like this is the right production. So the further you get the dot to the right, the better off you are in terms of making a sound prediction. And we're going to set some extra rules to make sure that if I get this far, I can make a determination that, yes, this is correct, or no, even though it looks like it ought to be correct, it may not be. The reason it may not be is that this may not be the only production under consideration. If this was the only production that could possibly work, then for sure, that was the right one. But maybe there's some other alternatives, and I still have to check between those alternatives. So when we do a prediction of a production, we put a dot in front of the right-hand side and match symbols. Okay, that's cool. But what about our old friend Lambda? He's not even actually a friend, he's a nemesis. Lambdas are what make our life miserable in some cases. Well, in this case, I can't see any extra context. So Lambda is one of these things that immediately I predict a Lambda, I've matched the entire right-hand side, which is nothing, and I have to make a decision. So it turns out that when we go back to the famous problem with production number 2 in our grammar, it was lambdas, in part, that was causing the grief. that made me change the grammar. So in this particular case, if I happen to have a Lambda production, matching extra context doesn't buy me anything. It's one of those put up or shut up right now. You've got to make the decision. So the notion will be then, when I start a parse out, I'm going to do exactly what I did with top-down, except I'm going to allow myself multiple choices. Remember, a top-down predictive parser would say, I know for sure, starting with the start symbol S, which of these three productions, in this case three, is appropriate. In this case, I don't do that. I'm going to keep a set of possibilities. So I don't know if this guy's going to win or that guy's going to win, so I track them both. So I say, maybe it's the first production, and that means I'm going to have to match an A, B, C, and D, or it could be the second, in which case I'll match an E, F, and G. And in these little examples, lowercase are terminals, uppercase are non-terminals, just to make it easy to understand the intent. Or I could have S goes to H, and I'm not sure if that's an I or an L, probably an L, because that's a Helvetica font. And those are my three choices. I don't know which of those three are the appropriate one yet, so I'm going to track them all. Just like the beginning of season, you don't know who's going to win the championship in whatever league you're in. But the deeper you get into the season, teams fall ahead or fall behind. So it might be a situation by the end of August, or what's the famous thing, by 4th of July, your team's out of contention if you're in baseball, because you're so many games behind, where other teams are playing well and they still might win. So in this case, it's like opening day. Everybody has a perfect record and everybody thinks my team's going to be the champion this year. So what we do is when we see these predictions, we have to do something called closure. And the reason for that is if I put a dot in front of a non-terminal, I don't match a non-terminal directly. What I say is I'm going to match some tokens derived from that non-terminal. So what I'm going to have to do is add in further predictions. Here's my example. I'm saying I'm going to predict the first symbol I see is an A. But that's a non-terminal. My scanner is not going to go along and give me an A. It's going to give me some symbols which, when matched through a production, will result in a cap A. So what I do is, when I say, okay, I'm predicting an A, the dot says the next symbol you're going to match is an A. It's a non-terminal. So I find all the productions that have an A as the left-hand side and add those. So this is saying, hey, if I'm going to match an A, I've got to do it two ways, either by matching PQR or matching little s followed by cap T. Since I have a dot in front of a P, I may need to repeat that. And what we'll generally do is whenever I have a dot, let's look at the little algorithm here to make it look like real computing. Whenever I have a set of these productions with a dot that are called configurations, and if you look at the line right below the repeat where I see the dot in front of a cap B, if B is in fact a non-terminal, I add all the productions with B as a left-hand side and predict their right-hand side and keep doing that until I have all the predictions that are possible in the grammar. Let's take a tangible example here. So say I have S goes to AB and I'm going to predict that. So when I predict A, I have to predict the second production. Predicting the second production predicts the C production, and predicting the C production also may predict the D production. So let's look at that with notation. So I predict the A, dot in front of a C, that means I got to predict the C. That's a dot in front of a cap D or a C. I didn't have quite room to fit it on here. And that finally goes ahead and predicts a dot D. So this is what we end up with, and it looks complex. But all it's really doing is following all the possibilities the grammar says. It says you want to match an S, you've got to do an A. You want to do an A, you've got to do a C. You want to do a C, you've got to do a D or a C. And if I have a dot in front of a terminal, I have an out. All I have to say is, okay, if I see a little D, that's a way of matching a cap D. That means I can go to production three and move the dot from before the cap D into the middle of the configuration, saying I'm halfway done. I matched half the production so far. When I actually see a symbol that I match, that's either by reading a terminal symbol or by matching an entire right-hand side and replacing that right-hand side with the left-hand side, I do something called a shift. Remember all that business we were talking about, shift reduce? This is where the terminology comes from. The shift says, as the name suggests, that if I have the dot in front of a symbol, like X toward the bottom, and I want to match an X, All I do is take that configuration and move the dot one symbol to the right. So if you look at the bottom of the algorithm, it says, hey, you were predicting that I had already matched an alpha. I want to match an X, and then I want to match a delta. And sure enough, I saw a symbol X. What I now have is a new configuration with the dot advanced. And the notion is, as I read more and more, the dot goes further and further to the right until I have the entire right-hand side matched, in which case I'm about to say I'm ready to do a reduce. So here's a case that I alluded to earlier. If I have the configuration up top and the symbol I want to match X is C, I look at all the configurations and say anything that has a cap C, a dot in front of a cap C, advance the dot. All those other guys drop out. That's how I get rid of elements of the set. It says, hey, the first guy wanted to match an A, but you didn't see an A, you saw a C. So in this case, I say, okay, I matched the C, advanced the dot. Now I'm predicting a D, and the way I do that is by predicting its right-hand sides, which include D goes to little d. And this just continues on. Finally, I get the dot to the far right of a production. That's called reduce. Well, when I get the dot to the far right, if I can just do a reduction, I'm fine. Otherwise, I may have a conflict between doing a reduction now and doing a shift. That's something we saw earlier. That's a shift-reduce conflict. We'll have to figure out how to resolve that. Or, in rare cases, you can have two productions that both want to complete at the same time, and you have to choose between those two productions. That's called a reduce-reduce error. Those are less common, but they can exist. So we need to decide if we have a shift-reduce or a reduce-reduce conflict, how to make the choice. One of the ways we did it in doing the if-then-else problem is simply said, give shift priority. Another alternative, a better one in some cases, is to look at the next input symbol and make a choice. So what we'll do is we'll go ahead and say, okay, I've already matched the configuration A goes to alpha. And I will say, am I convinced that that is the right reduction to do? What I'll do is I'll go ahead and look at the next token beyond the dot, the next token that hasn't been matched with the dot, and say, could that token, called CT for current token, follow an A? That's very similar to what we did in LL. It says, if the next token could follow an A, hey, it makes great sense to reduce alpha to A. On the other hand, if it can't, well, then it makes no sense. If I reduce alpha to A and current token could never follow an A is not the right symbol to reduce to. So in that case, I don't do the reduce. So the notion is if I have a dot at the far right of a production and the next token can follow the left-hand side, I'll consider the reduction to be appropriate. Otherwise, I won't. So here's an example that shows us. And this is something you saw in some of your cases, like remember the old if-then and if-then-else where you had the old shift-reduce error? In one case, it says, hey, I've seen a complete production. In my example, it's A goes to alpha dot. But another one says, hey, wait a minute. Here's a case where I could be in the middle of matching the B production. I've matched beta part already, and I'm ready to match a little A. Is that the right thing to do? So what I do here is I go ahead and say, let's look at the next token. If the next token is a little A, I'll go ahead and reduce. I'm sorry, I won't reduce. I'll go ahead and do the shift. If the next token can follow cap A, then I'll do a reduction. And it should never be the case that any token tells me to do both. If so, that's an unresolvable shift-reduce error. We can also have reduce-reduce errors, like the following, where I have two productions and I have the dot at the far right of both of them. In that particular case, I verify that the follow for capital A and the follow for capital B are distinct. In that case, I simply go ahead and say, let's look at the next token. If it can follow an A, I'll do the top production. If it can follow a B, I'll do the bottom production. And I make our choice. Well, this looks all pretty complex, all these dots moving around and all. One of the beautiful things that you don't realize at first, but turns out to be nice, is I can pre-compute all the configuration sets, that is, productions with dots, in advance, and table them away so that I have all this information. I'll show you an example shortly that tells me what the possibilities are And I can then have information that actually follow what to do. So here's an example, and don't follow this too closely. What I'll do is I'll start with a set of configurations, which I'll call a state, that represent predicting the start symbol. Then for each particular symbol that I might match, I do an advance by doing a shift and compute a new state, possibly doing predictions, and continue that until I have all the possible configuration sets that might ever occur during a parse. Now, at first glance, you might think, oh, this is terrible. There could be millions or billions of those. Turns out not so at all. Turns out typically you have a few hundred for a grammar of something like CSX size, even for something like Java or C or C++, probably not more than 1,000. Now, 1,000 is a lot in some circumstances, but to a computer, it's chump change. I mean, 1,000 of anything is nothing to bother a computer. So here's a visualization. I think this is actually what, in some cases, when you're doing error messages from CUP, they were showing you parts of these, where they had a little marker that represented the dot, and they were showing you, I've matched this much, and I'm in trouble, for example. So at the very beginning, it says, hey, I know for sure in CSX Lite that a program has to be exactly one choice. Match a left brace, then match statements, match a right brace, and match EOF. Okay, so I go to S1 and it says, okay, suppose I advance the dot past the brace. What am I going to do next? Well, it says I'm going to see statements. Statements can either be a single statement or my good buddy lambda. How do I tell if I do lambda? Well, I look at the next token and see if the symbol can follow statements. If it can, I do the reduction immediately. Otherwise, I don't. I continue shifting. It says, what about statement? Well, it can be an ID or an if. State 2 says, well, suppose I match statements. Then I have the dot in front of a brace. Later on, I'll move the dot in front of the brace. If I am predicting statements and I see a single statement, what do? Well, I can have statements go to lambda or predict the statements, and that can be an ID or an if. And if I trace these all the way through, I get these, exactly 21 for CSX Lite. And these are all the configurations of parsing I'll ever come across. And each one of those, the configurations will tell me what it is I have to do. The cool thing about this is I don't have to do my predictions immediately, unlike LL. I can wait until the dot moves all the way to the far right and then make a decision, a reduction typically, and say, okay, I now have seen the entire input. So, for example, if I look at state 18, it says, hey, you've seen an expression, you've seen a plus, you've seen an ID, you've matched it all. And guess what? There are no more competitors. That's the only possible configuration in the set. So this is one of those cases where if you go to a horse race and there's only one horse running, and you see him get all the way to the finish line, it makes a heck of a lot of sense, says, that's my horse. So in this case, if I'm in state 18, I said I've matched an expression, I've matched a plus, I've matched an ID, and I have to decide which production should I do. That's the only choice, so bingo, I take it. So any case where I get to a set that has only one choice, that's kind of like LL. I don't have to have any hard decisions. All I have to do is verify that's what's expected is there. If it's not there, that means it's a syntax error. Other cases like state 17, I have some choices. It says in this case, I've gone ahead and matched the prefix of an if, and I have to see the statement that's the then part. So it says, what are my two choices? Either an assignment or an if. So this is saying, take a timeout on the upper if, match an assignment or another if, match it completely, that'll reduce to a statement. Then I go back to the top configuration and say, okay, I needed to see a statement after the if then or if expression. I've done so, and now I've seen a complete if. So it's able to delay when part of an expression is matched and the other part will be matched a little bit later. So to make this run particularly effective, I'll create a table called the configuration table that'll have a number of actions. One of them is reduce I, where I is the ith production. It says I've looked at everything, and production 7 is the one to reduce right now. Another is shift. It says I'm not ready to make a reduction yet. Please match the current token, and I'm going to update my configuration set to reflect the fact I've read one more piece of information. Accept is at the very end that says the parse is complete incorrect. We're out of here. It's done. And error says none of the three above work, so you must have given me something that's invalid. I can't shift, I can't reduce, I can't accept. It's an error, guaranteed. And the way we make those decisions is we'll have a table called A for action. It's indexed by a configuration set, which we call a state, and a particular terminal symbol, T. And it says if the ith production is A goes to alpha, and we have A goes to alpha dot in C, and T is in the follow of the left-hand side A, go ahead and do a reduction. If we have a dot in front of a configuration for T, a dot in front of a T for configuration, we'll go ahead and do a shift. Otherwise, we'll do neither of those. And our rule for something to be LLR is that those action tables will always be a single shift, a single reduce, or an error situation. So I'm never confused as to which choice to do, a reduction or shift. And as it says here, if the action isn't unique, we have a shift reduce or reduce reduce error. It's a situation also, by the way, that if you shift an EOF, that's considered to be an accept because endophile only appears at the very end and that has to terminate the parse. So if you can, in fact, shift an EOF, that's not just a reduction. That's a termination with a valid parse saying, yes, indeed, I accept that input. If none of those occur, then you have a syntax error. And here's our little driver. And notice that's not much more complex than what we had when we were doing LL type parsing. It says, let's let S be the top state and CT be the current token. And what we'll do is we'll go into the table and say, are you error? Otherwise, if so, we'll do an error message. If you're an accept, we'll finish the parse correctly. Shift, we'll do a go to action, which will move the dot one position further and call the scanner for a new token. Otherwise, we do a reduce, remove the number of states corresponding to the right-hand side, get a new top state, match the left-hand side, and resume parsing. So here's our table. It looks pretty complex, but this is actually used a little later. So the way to read this is that if it has an R in it, that means reduce such and such a production. If it has an S, that means shift the symbol. There's only a single A, that means accept, and all the blanks mean error situations. So it says if I were in state zero and I saw a right brace, I go to a blank entry, and that means you can't, in state zero, you can't match a right brace. We also have a go-to table, that's for doing shifts. It says if you're in such and such a state, like state zero, and you see a left brace as a shift, go to state one. And the various numbers represent states, and the blanks, again, represent erroneous situations where you have some kind of parsing error. Okay, let's go to the example, and this is where it all kind of ties together. So what's going to happen here is the parser actually doesn't see the configurations. We're just looking at those to make sense of it all. So we start out with state zero. I go to my entry and say, what's my current token? It's a left brace. And I go to the action and say, what's the action of a left brace and a zero? Anybody have a table in front of them? It should be the case that it's a shift, and the go-to on the shift says go to state one. Notice state one has moved the dot across the brace. The zero sitting back there says that you had started matching production, the very first production, and you're not complete on that yet. So I say, what's my next input? It's an A. In that particular case, I see an A. It ends up predicting statement goes to ID equals expert. Okay, so now for sure it knows what it's in. It says you began a production that represents an assignment. Match and equal, I go ahead and do that. I now have something at the bottom that says, okay, I see a plus. What do I do when I see a plus? Well, notice the bottom production says match an ID, which is what I do. And it says, hey, I've gone ahead and matched a production. Expression goes to ID. So in that particular case, I reduce production number 8. The way I do that is I pop one state off, the one that represented the ID, and go ahead and do a shift of the expert. That gets me to the top state for number 11, which says I matched all the assignment except the semicolon. What do I do? Well, I see a plus, and one of my predictions is say, hey, the expression does not have to terminate yet. I can see a plus and see a bigger expression. So I go ahead and do that, match the expression. I then see an ID, I match that, and says, hey, I've seen an expression plus an ID. I pop off three states because I moved the dot three positions and advanced the dot past an expir. Gets me back to state 11. It says, hey, I see a semicolon. My input's a semicolon. Let's shift. That takes me down to expression 14, configuration 14. I have 1, 2, 3, 4 symbols on the right-hand side. I pop off those and match production number 4. In that particular case, I've seen a complete statement, and I see a brace, and it says, hey, that means statements goes to lambda. So I go ahead in that particular case and advance the dot past the statements. I then pop off to get back to program, goes to brace statements dot, match a left brace, match an EOF, and do an accept. Now, again, those are a lot of steps. So what I recommend is at some point when you're preparing for an exam or just trying to understand what's going on, at your own leisure, go through the tables and understand what's going on. But the upshot of all this is it's able to track all the possible productions that may be in play and always has an anticipation of a valid move and recognizes automatically invalid moves. This also automatically catches errors. Here's the example I used previously where I had my assignment backwards. So in this case, it starts out normally. But when it gets to the point where in the bottom box, it says, I matched an ID and I'm expecting an assignment. It says, wait a minute, my next token is a plus. An assignment and a plus are not the same. I have a match, an illegal match. And I go to a blank entry and say, hey, that was erroneous. It must be that the next input token, plus, is illegal. And that's the basis of your error message. So why are we talking about LALR? Well, because it's more powerful. And it's always the case there, you know, that you want more power. It'll give me a bigger engine or a bigger car or whatever. If anybody ever seen the movie This Is Spinal Tap, it's pretty funny. And what do the guys want when they're buying an amplifier? They want something that goes up to 11. As all the others, you know, in terms of volume control, only goes up to 10. And they're smart enough to know 11 is bigger than 10. So I want an amplifier that goes up to 11. Well, in this case, I want a parsing technique that does as much as I'll need. So in this case, it does everything LL can do and more. Why does it do everything LL can do? Well, if I feed an LL grammar into LLR, it'll always have a unique prediction. So those sets that have multiple things with a dot will always have a single thing with a dot. Hey, that's cool. If I have a single thing with a dot, I can never make a mistake, and therefore the LL predictions guarantee correctness. But not everything is LL. Remember we had to kind of mess around with the grammar when we had a production that said ID could be part of an assignment or part of a method call. Well, in our particular situation, well, let's go back to LL. LL was in trouble because it had to make a prediction looking only at ID, but it couldn't. Both of those were valid, and it says, I can't make a prediction. In this particular case, if I'm allowed more context, I say, well, okay, let's hold it. I don't have to really make the decision yet. Let's read another symbol. I read an ID, move the dot, and now I say, if I see an equal, I'll know I'm in an assignment. If I see a left paren, I know I'm in a method call. Those are distinct, and now I can make my choice. So common prefixes do not mess up LALR parsing. Also, I showed you earlier, and now I'll make a point of it. In LL parsing, left recursion was fatal. In this situation, in LL, it says, well, if I ever predict that first production once, I'll do it again and again and again. LALR says, no, you're doing this bass-ackwards. I don't want to worry about the recursion yet. I'm going to match a symbol and figure out what context it belongs in. So in this case, I'm going to match the ID first, and I'll go back to ID dot, and then I go back and says, okay, you predicted an expir. I found an expir in the form of an ID. It moves the dot past and says, hey, wait a minute, you're golden now. Now I can do a plus ID in that particular case. And having been able to do that, I can then go ahead and either match an entire expression or continue matching another suffix and another and another. So left recursion just doesn't bother you at all, which is a big plus. But we have to be a little careful. You can't expect too much. Here's the problem you had. that was not automatically solved until we went into this automatic shift reduce. What happened here is we matched the entire if prefix and says, hey, top line says I've seen an if statement, an if then, without an else. The bottom one says, well, maybe you do have an else. The rule would be, how do I check which of those to do? Well, I go ahead and say, is it possible for an else to follow a statement? And the answer is yes, it is. The bottom line shows you an example of that. So either of those actions could possibly be correct. So what we did in our Java cop, it says in the case of a shift reduce, we'll tell it, okay, go ahead and do the shift. That means forget about the top production, which might have been reduced, because I want to go ahead and match the else with the current if, making the if else match the closest nearest if, which is the right thing to do. So in this case, it was a true conflict, but we said, we being human beings are smarter than you are. The bottom production, which is the shift, is better. So we went ahead and said, expect one shift reduce error, resolve it in terms of a shift, and you'll be okay. And now you get a little sense of why it worked. And one last thing I've been promising, and finally I can get to it. This is a question of why did I do productions number 2 and 3 so foolishly, apparently so. So remember, this should have been the case that member decals should have been the field decals, 0 or more, followed by method decals, 0 or more. Number of people said, why didn't I do it? Maybe a few of you even tried it, saying, well, I'll fix it up for him. He doesn't know what he's doing. And it turns out that if we go through the analysis, we're going to have a problem. And the problem really reduces to the fact that I can have 0 fields. That's the case of, say, I have a low world, a class that only has a method in it. Or I might have a class that has no methods in it. That's how I get the equivalent of structs that you see in C or C++, a bundle of heterogeneous data, but no methods to go with them. So either of those are possible. So we have a production that says field decals may go to lambda and method decals may go to lambda, and there's some other productions that are involved. So we start out with something like that, and we start building the parser. So in this particular case, I predict field decals, and a field decal can be lambda, or it can be some field declaration like int id. But wait a minute, look at those bottom two guys. I have a shift-reduce conflict. It says if I wanted to, I could go ahead and said field decals goes to lambda. That's equivalent to saying there were no fields. Or I could start matching production number 4 and say that I'm going to match a field. Well, wait a minute, that's not automatically fatal, though. I go ahead and check the follow set for fields. What can follow fields? Hey, methods can. And what does a method sometimes begin with? Int ID. No, just like, and that's part of the problem, is that way back C declared variables, like int ID, semicolon, and a method or a function, int ID, parens, body, and so on. They both start out the same way. Can I go ahead and say, well, we'll just do that trick we did for if then else. We'll say always do the shift. Would that work? And the answer is no. If I did the shift first, that means if I went ahead and had a class that had no fields, but an integer-valued method, you know, something that did mathematics, like complex numbers or extended precision, it would say, okay, I'm always going to start matching an int ID semicolon, meaning I'm going to require you have a field. But you don't always want to have a field. Sometimes all you want are methods. So I have a shift-reduce conflict. Looking at the look-ahead doesn't help. Doing the shift all the time doesn't help. Doing the reduce wouldn't work either in that particular case, because maybe I actually do have a field that I should match. So the grammar was a good try and it didn't work. So I, you know, just come up with some set and I said, what's killing me here? What's killing me here is that darn lambda. Lambdas are bad because they make me put up or shut up now. It's like those guys at Vegas. They say, I have to do my prediction on who's going to win before the game begins. I say, no. I like to wait later. Wait until the third quarter, the fourth quarter, 2 seconds before the buzzer. Then I'll make my decision. So how do I do that? Well, here's what I ended up doing in this particular case. Oh, no, this is still explaining the previous one. Sorry. So here's where I did it, rewrite it. So now we have member decals goes to a field decal, ugly, followed by members. Okay, but this still works. First thing is, if it works and gives me what I want, and I can build a parser out of it, then I'm okay. So notice this still does work. I can go ahead and have the second production generate only methods, never use the first production, and therefore I can have something that has no fields within it. On the other hand, I can have some fields, and method decals are allowed to go to lambda, and therefore I could have something that had only fields but no methods, something like a conventional struct that has some fields in it and just encapsulates the data. So it gives me what I want. Now let's go ahead and start building, and we go towards the bottom. And in this particular case, it says, I got a lambda. But wait a minute, the lambda was method decals. What can follow a method decals? Well, if I go ahead back to remember a method decals in that particular case was at the far right of, first came all the field decals and then came all the member decals. So what follows a member decals is a right brace. That's not a problem. If I see a right brace, I know I'm at the end of the class. So that's not going to kill me. But notice what I do have is I have those bottom two lines that says, hey, maybe you're a field, in which case you begin with an int. Or maybe you're a method, in which case you begin with an int. But that's no problem. That's previously where we saw two statements that began with an ID. So those bottom three configurations don't cause me a problem. I'm assuming I have an int, but I'm not sure yet whether it's an int as part of a field or it's part of a method. So what I do is I wait. Again, I can't make my decision straight away, so I'm saying, I'm just going to wait, and you're going to show me more context, guy. So what's going to happen is, well, let's go back. I think I have it here. What's going to happen is I'm going to see an int, and that's going to move the dot past the int for the bottom two configurations. Still don't know enough. What's the next thing I'm going to see? An identifier. Could be the name of a variable. Could be the name of a method. But now having done that, guess what? I then see a semicolon, in which case it must have been a variable declaration, or I see a left paren. Remember, in our language, you always have parens around the arguments, even if it's an empty argument list. So when I read int and ID, now I can make my decision. It's rather much like letting me wait until deep into the game when it becomes pretty clear who's going to win and who's going to lose. So then I say, oh, it must either be a field decal because I saw a semicolon, or it must be a method decal because I saw a left paren. I made my decision. So the parser was able to make the choice, and therefore I could have the syntax I wanted and have the thing automatically be generated. So that's why it turned out productions 2 and 3 were the way they were. I had to kind of finesse the parser into letting me make a delay. And the way I made it have delay is I didn't let field decals immediately go to lambda. I sort of did the situation where I'll match all my methods first, and then I'll match fields not left to right, which seems normal, but right to left. Seems kind of odd, but it works, and I get what I wanted. So that was just an example of sometimes you have to massage the grammar a little bit. Fortunately, it doesn't happen too often. In some ways, all this is an inheritance from a bad decision way back when. Occasionally, for historical reasons, decisions are made that aren't necessarily very good, and they sort of get encapsulated into the culture or into the rules, and you're kind of stuck with them. So in that particular situation, if I would have had methods or fields look different at the beginning, so they both didn't begin with int ID, then I'd be okay. But that's not the way I had it. Let's see how we're doing on time, I think. Okay, cool. So we'll simply say, and this will be the end, I'll talk about parsing. Next time we'll start talking about type checking. What are some of the properties about LL and LLR parsers? Take your choice. One of them is the parsing is guaranteed to be correct. It can never make a mistake if the grammar is acceptable. Why? Well, it's always a situation the parsers strive to have a unique decision at each point, a unique prediction, a unique shift, or a unique reduce. It never has a case where two possibilities both have to be accepted. So the prediction's a guarantee, the parser cannot make a mistake. Both kinds of parsers detect errors as soon as possible and do it automatically. What happens is it keeps matching symbols as long as they're possibly a valid prefix of a program. Immediately that you find an error. And notice an error means you cannot have something which with the symbols already read is a valid prefix. That's what syntax error means. It does not fit in the context you're in. It automatically defines that because there are no production that I can continue matching with that erroneous symbol. So that's why it's the case, you may have noticed that in your parser, that when it complains, the parse error is either at the symbol you want, or sometimes it's the symbol just before it. Either the symbol before it led you into a bad prediction, or the current one is bad. But the error messages are very good because they're very well located with respect to where the error almost certainly was. All the grammars are unambiguous. That means you never have to worry about the user expecting one parse tree and the parser building a different parse tree. Why? Well, at each step, the parser has only one choice. If it has only one choice, then it's a situation there that there's only one parse tree that could have been built. If you could have built more than one parse tree, at some point there would have been a choice that says doing this would be valid, but also doing that would be valid. And that's the basis for saying, hey, I can't parse. So grammars are unambiguous, which is good. That means we get a distinctive and unique parse. And finally, parsers are fast. Either LL or LALR requires only linear time with respect to the number of tokens or the size of the tree. So you double the size of a program, it takes twice as long to parse. That's to be expected. It's not like quadratic or cubic or exponential, where the program gets a little bit bigger and it gets way, way slower. And the reason for that is the parsers, if you look at the tables, always do a fixed amount of work per token. There's no way where you can hide an indefinite amount of work. So because of that, it's the case that the parsers are, in fact, linear, which is the best you could possibly hope to do. And one reading assignment for next time, and this will be when we start talking about type checking. So in an hour, I've actually managed to say all I needed to say about LLR parsing. You may want to read the textbook or reread the notes just to have a second look at it. It's certainly not trivial stuff, but it's a very useful technique, and it's good now that you finally built the parser. Now you know what the darn thing was talking about. Sorry about that, but that's the way it is. So now's a good time to take a break. We'll take about 10 minutes, and we'll have a final half-hour session, maybe not even that, but it'll be a case where if anybody has any remaining questions, presumably in anticipation of the exam, it'll be a good time to do it. So it's about, take about 12 minutes, and we'll see you at 7:50.